K-Mud Podcast presents.
Good morning, and welcome to Heart of the Earth. This is a program about Native Americans and other Indigenous cultures. My name is Agnes, and I'll be with you until 10 a.m. And I opened with Native American legends, and that was Eye of the Sun. I just thought it was kind of, you know, it's been raining, so yeah. How about the Eye of the Sun? Well, it's been a year since Leonard Peltier has been freed. And I thought about calling him, you know, maybe interview him. And I said, oh, no, I know how he gets when him and I start talking. And, you know, I'll have to keep stopping him. He might curse. And I said, you know, I'm sure someone's going to cover this. And, of course, Indian Country Today News did. And it's just, you know, far much better than I think I could have done. And so I thought I'd share this with you. And it's from Kevin Barzek, and he has been a long, long time writer for Indian Country Today and many other publications, and is really well known in Lakota Nation. And he says, even the doors of a maximum security prison could no longer hold Leonard Peltier. On February 18th of 2025, nearly a month after former President Joe Biden pardoned Peltier, Nick Tilson, founder and executive officer of the Indian Collective, and Holly Cook Marcaro, the collective's former federal lobbyist, stood outside the Coleman Federal Corrections Complex in Florida. They had hoped to meet Peltier inside the prison's maximum security wing, but were told they had to wait outside for the Turtle Mountain Chippewa activist. As they stood in the parking lot, two prison staff members walked out and then turned and began examining the prison's main doors. Quote, "It's like it's broken or something," Tilson heard one of the guards say. Intrigued, Tilson walked up to the men to ask them what was wrong. They told him the prisoner's main doors appeared to have been broken, the first time either of them could remember that happening. Tilson said to them, quote, "What do you think the chances are that, you know, on the day that Leonard Peltier is getting out the door of Coleman, the maximum security prison is broken open?" To which one of the guards replied in a deep southern accent, "It's Creator, God." That was day one. Today is day 366 of Peltier's release from prison. So what has the past year been for the 81-year-old who spent 49 years and 2 months behind bars? In an interview with Indian Country Today this week, Peltier said life had been pretty good since being released following former President Biden's decision to grant him clemency as he was leaving office on January 20th of 2025. Peltier, who suffered from diabetes, vision loss, heart problems, and aortic aneurysm, and the lingering effects of COVID-19 while in prison, said he has seen his health improve steadily as he has received quality medical care and enjoyed nutritious food. But he still struggles with poor vision following years of medical neglect, a particularly tragic deficiency for a man who spent decades painting in prison. The past year has seen Peltier travel to events in Minneapolis and South Dakota and entertaining celebrities and Native dignitaries, as well as Indigenous people and others who have advocated for his release. This past September, several musicians, including Native rocker Keith Sokola, John Densmore, drummer of The Doors, and Native guitarist and flutist Aaron White, performed a private acoustic concert on Peltier's front lawn. Quote, "It was a great honor to have them come down and visit me and play some music," Peltier said. Tom Morello, guitarist for Rage Against the Machine, also has spoken to Peltier several times and even donated a signed Fender guitar to sell in order to raise funds for Peltier's living expenses. Peltier even corresponded with Robert Redford prior to the actor's death on September 16th of 2025, Cook Macaro said. And he said other musicians have asked to visit him. Quote, "Neil Young wants to come down," he said. "A few other big-name musicians want to come down and say hello. I want to be able to thank them, too, for all their years. Some of these people have been supporting me for over 40-some years. Journalists from Harper's Bazaar, the New York Times, the Associated Press, the Minneapolis Star Tribune have made the long trek to Turtle Mountain on the Canadian border to talk to Peltier and tell his story. So did Gamut. All right. In January, Cook Macaro and former Secretary of Interior Deb Haaland, Laguna Pueblo, visited Peltier. Quote, "She played such a key role in making sure that he was granted clemency," Cook Macaro said of Haaland. After leaving Coleman Prison, Tilson and Cook Macaro drove Peltier to a safe house. On the way there, Peltier sat in the back seat of the rented SUV, pumping his fist and swaying to Redbone's "Come and Get Your Love." At the safe house, Tilton and others prayed with Peltier and smudged him off before loading him onto a plane bound for his home in North Dakota. When they left Florida, it had been 80 degrees, but it was nearly 20 degrees below zero when the plane landed in Spirit Lake, North Dakota, that day. Nevertheless, hundreds of people lined the road leading into the Turtle Mountain Indian Reservation, and the next night gathered at a casino in Belcourt for a welcome home ceremony. The next evening in the casino event center, before hundreds of supporters, journalists, and tribal leaders, Peltier walked into the room and held his fist high in the air as women trilled and men war-whooped. Quote, "I don't think he realized how big of an icon he was," Tilson said. And according to the terms of his clemency, Peltier is unable to travel beyond 100 miles of his home in Belcourt without approval from the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Quote, "I'm not totally out of prison yet," he said. "Basically, I'm still under confinement." And while he's been able to leave a few times for medical treatments, he's only been granted 3 furloughs to travel beyond 100 miles of his home over the past year, he said. He was able to attend and participate in a Sundance ceremony in June of 2025 on the Pine Ridge Reservation, the first time he returned there since he was imprisoned. And during the ceremony, dancers took Peltier to the tree in the center of the sacred circle and prayed with him. Then in October of 2025, he was allowed to travel to Rapid City, South Dakota on Indigenous Peoples Day to take part in a march honoring survivors and children who died at federal boarding schools. Peltier, a boarding school survivor himself, joined more than 270 people in the march, though he was unable to walk the entire way. Addressing the crowd, Peltier promised to remain a voice for Indigenous people. Quote, "I love my people. I think we're the greatest nation in the world," he said. "I'm going to stay a fighter for you until I die." Then in November of 2025, he traveled to Minneapolis, the birthplace of the American Indian Movement. And while there, he attended a screening at the Minneapolis American Indian Center of the documentary Free Leonard Peltier, which charts his long fight for freedom and eventual release. He also visited the Red Lake Nation's Minneapolis office. "Many who got to see and meet him were overcome with emotions," Cook Macaro said. Quote, "Leonard has been such a symbol of Indigenous resistance for so many decades and for generations of Native people. Just seeing him free brought so many to tears," she said. Since then, however, federal prison officials have chosen to deny most other furlough requests by Peltier. Recently, they approved his request to visit his oldest daughter, Lisa Peltier, just before her death on February 11th in Grand Forks, North Dakota. But by the time his request was approved, his daughter had died. Quote, "I went to say goodbye to her body. That's the best I got," he said. Tilson said he believes former and current FBI officials have demanded that Peltier no longer be allowed to travel. Peltier said he's been invited, would like to visit the Vatican in Italy. He had hoped to travel there in June, but hasn't heard yet whether his furlough request will be approved. He said he wants to pray to pay his respects to the late Pope Francis, who advocated for his release prior to his death in April of 2025, as well as other popes who supported his release. Quote, "They put a lot of pressure over the years to try to get me out of prison," he said. And while there, he also plans to ask Pope Leo the 14th to visit him and attend a service at St. Anne's Catholic Church in Belcourt. But he also plans to demand an apology from the Pope for the Catholic Church's efforts to eradicate Indigenous people, culture, and languages. Quote, "I'm going to ask him to make an apology to all the Native nations that the Church executed, murdered, and committed genocide on," he said. Bottom line, Peltier isn't finished yet. Quote, "I haven't given up. I have not retired. I have not sold out," he said. Quote, "To me, it's treason to do something like that because we are sovereign nations." As long as he remains close to home, Peltier can travel where he wants, though he still has to submit a weekly schedule of his plans to prison officials, Tilson said. He visited and spoke at the Turtle Mountain Community College in Belcourt and attended a high school wrestling match. He's attended several traditional ceremonies. He's often visited by local tribal and spiritual leaders. Quote, "I can't seem to go nowhere without somebody wanting to take a picture with me," Peltier said. "I'm very grateful to them for showing that type of welcome." the Indian Collective, which helped secure Peltier's release and purchase his home for him, has continued to advocate for him, ensuring he continues to get proper medical care and his other needs are met. Indian wants nothing in return from Leonard other than for him just to be free, Tilson said. Holly Cook Macaro also has continued helping Peltier since his release, coordinating his social calendar and organizing his personal collection of documents related to his legal efforts, as well as FBI files such as the agency's interview with Marlon Brando. The late actor was a longtime supporter of Peltier's and even provided him with a recreational vehicle to use while he was fleeing authorities after the 1975 shootout. Quote, that too has been something that has been really great to watch, is all of these things that are coming back to him, from his paintings, which I returned one to correspondence, Cook Macaro said. Until Biden's last-minute action, Peltier has seen 8 presidents leave office without pardoning him or commuting his sentence. His release came after decades of grassroots organizing and legal action. Tilson said after he walked out of prison on February 18th of 2025, Peltier walked up to him, hugged him, and asked him, "Is this real?" "This is real," he told him.
And Moses said to Pharaoh, set my people free. But Pharaoh said to Moses, I don't buy your jive. I don't believe that miracles and God is alive. In this modern age, in this modern civilized age, so go and talk to the sky. And Moses said to Nixon, let my peace people be. But Nixon said to Moses, I don't buy your jive. I don't believe that miracles and God is alive.
In this modern age, in this modern civilized age,
so go and talk to the sky. And Moses said to Brezhnev, set my people free. But Brezhnev said to Moses, I don't buy your jive. I don't believe that miracles and God is alive.
In this modern age, in this scientific age,
so go and talk to the sky.
America, set my Leonard free.
Set him free.
Don't you dare say that you don't buy my jive. Don't you believe that miracles and God is alive.
Then set my Leonard free.
Set him free.
Then set my Leonard free.
Set him free.
Then set my Leonard free.
Set him free. Set him free.
So come my brothers and sisters,
everybody,
and join the singing with me.
Sing with me.
Cause everybody, I do, God is God. How do you believe that miracles and God is alive? In this ancient age, in this ancient uncivilized age, so come and talk to the sky. So come and talk to the sky. So come and talk to the sky.
And that was the Long Acre. The Long Acre Indian Head Penny Band, and they gave us Talk to the Sky, Set Leonard Peltier Free. Well, last week, I know I had a lot to say about Bad Bunny and his performance at halftime, and, you know, it's just, it was so just incredible, and but there's been more response, and so I thought I'd share this with you, because the reaction to Bad Bunny's Super Bowl halftime performance has been loud and predictable. Critics complain that, quote, they didn't understand the language, or that the show felt too foreign, too political, too Latin. Yet beneath the noise lies a deeper truth. The performance carried a cultural weight that many viewers missed. For indigenous people across the hemisphere, Bad Bunny's presence on that stage echoed a long ongoing story of survival and resurgence, one rooted in Tayano identity. Bad Bunny has spoken openly about identifying with the Tayano heritage, a connection that places him within a movement more than 50 years in the making. Tayano indigeneity is not a trend or a marketing tool. It is a revitalization effort that encompasses people throughout the greater Caribbean islands and their diasporic communities in the United States and Canada. And since the 1970s, families and individuals from Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, Cuba, Jamaica, Haiti, and other islands have gathered to reclaim ancestral indigenous roots. They have formed associations and Yucaqueques, family tribal groups, reviving language, ceremony, music, dance, and craft traditions that colonial powers insisted were extinct. And I just want to interject here, because it was last year sometime when the actor John Leguizamo I think it was on CNN, and you know, went to different Latin countries. It was all about, but when he went to Puerto Rico, he ended up doing an indigenous ceremony, and it was just incredible to watch him participate in that, and to let people know, you know, that they have, you know, that the native people still exist in the Caribbean islands. And I remember, you know, in 1989, I believe it was, and I was in Ecuador, and it was, you know, all the nations, North, Central, and South America, all met in Ecuador, the belly of Mother Earth, to get ready for the 1992 500 years of resistance. And this Indian man got up and he said, you know, that he was the chief of the Caribbean Indians. And I went, what? And he said, he didn't say Dominican Republic. What did he say? Dominica? What? You know, and so I was just so intrigued, and I listened to him. And afterwards, I went up and talked to him, and he actually invited me. He said, please come to the island, come to Dominica, visit my people. And so the following year, my husband and I did go to Dominica. And to meet with the Carib people and the native people of the islands. And even when I was in Jamaica, I went, they had an Arawak village, and I made sure I went to see that. So just so you all know that they do exist very much alive today. In fact, when I was at that 1992, that conference for the 1992, I met a Tayana woman. And usually on Indigenous Peoples Day, I always play what I recorded with her that day. But to continue, the word extinct is central to understanding the movement. For centuries, scholars and governments insisted that Caribbean indigenous people had vanished. Spanish colonial policy enforced a deliberate, quote, whitening of Indians, erasing identity and extinguishing native title to land. The Tayano resurgence rose to direct defiance of that narrative. Tayano became a favored term of self ascription because it is best encompassed the scattered descendants of indigenous Caribbean communities. It signaled continuity, not disappearance. And in fact, in Haiti, they went up to one area in the mountains there and, you know, they did the DNA test, and it turned out that 90% of all these people living in Haiti all had Taino DNA in them. They all were part of the indigenous people there. But to continue, today Taino networks have cultural gatherings, academic conferences, and community events. They reconstruct the Taino insular Arawak language. They make ceremonial instruments, carve, weave, and dance. Dominican groups such as the Higua Yaqua hold important scholarly and cultural gatherings. The United Confederation of Taino Peoples sends delegates to the United Nations, often representing the International Indian Treaty Council, linking Caribbean indigeneity with North American tribal nations in global advocacy. This is not a fringe idea. It is a hemispheric resurgence with deep historical roots. The movement is also grounded in living communities. In the late 1890s, remote mountain settlements in eastern Cuba, places like La Rancheria and La Escondida, reached out to the intertribal, to the inner island Taino movement. These communities represent documented continuity of Indio settlements dating back centuries. These current Francisco Ramirez carries a hereditary title traceable to the 1660s. These are not reenactors or romanticized figures. They are indigenous people whose culture, spiritual, and agricultural practices have survived in the mountains for generations. Against this backdrop, Bad Bunny's Super Bowl performance takes on a different meaning when he steps into one of the largest stages in the world and brings Caribbean identity with him unapologetically in Spanish with rhythms rooted in indigenous and African lineage. He is not simply entertaining. He is participating in a long, ongoing reclamation of identity. He is refusing the extinction narrative that has shadowed Caribbean indigenous peoples for centuries. That refusal matters. It matters in a world where indigenous people from the Caribbean to the Northern Plains are still fighting to be recognized on their own lands. It matters when histories are dismissed, identities questioned, and cultures treated as relics. It matters when descendants of Taino communities continue to be told they do not exist. Indigeneity is a hemispheric wide story of survival, adaptation, and resurgence. The Taino movement is part of that story. Bad Bunny, whether critics understand it or not, stands within that story as well. Visible proof that the indigenous Caribbean is not gone, not forgotten, and not silent.
In 1493, Christopher Columbus stepped upon the shores of an island in the Caribbean known as Boriquen, the land of the great Lord. Today, Boriquen is known to most as Puerto Rico. As in the rest of the Antilles, Boriquen was populated by people who Columbus would call Indians. Today, they are known as the Taino, which means good or noble. Among the Indian tribes of the Antilles at the time of the encounter, the Taínos had the most highly developed social, religious, and political organization. The Taínos were powerful warriors but did not wage war unless necessary. The Taínos were farmers, fishermen, hunters, and gatherers. At the end of the day's tasks, the people would gather for song, dance, and the evening feast. They call these gatherings areitos, and it was one of the grandest social and ceremonial manifestations of the people. The areito was usually held in the batey, or the ceremonial ball and dance court. There, the people would dance and sing about traditions, war deeds, great caciques, or chiefs, and good harvest. They would also sing to the semis, or spirits, who they shared with the land, to Yokahu, the great spirit who lived in the sky, and to Atabesh, our Mother Earth. Everyone participated in the areto, or powwow, painting their bodies, adorning themselves with necklaces of shells and seeds, which rattled and helped to keep the rhythm of the dance. For musical instruments, they used maracas, or rattles, drums, fotutos, or conch shell trumpets, and flutes, all made from what the natural environment Mother Earth provided. True traditions are not testimonies of the past. They are a living force that takes heart and place in the forming of a present. The Arawak Mountain Singers are that living force for the present. The Arawak Mountain Singers are a Native American performing group whose name honors the original ancestral name of the Taínos and the mountains where they sought refuge from brutal Spanish oppression. The mountains are also where the people go to pray, to ask for spiritual guidance, and to seek their vision. The Arawak Mountain Singers are one of the only Native American performing group in the world that are solely comprised of and represent the indigenous people of the Caribbean, like the Dominican Republic, or Quisqueya, Cuba, and Puerto Rico, or Boriquen. We are the products of our ancestors, and we unite and share our music with other Native music of all of our brothers and sisters of Turtle Island. To this we say Han Han, and may we walk in unity and peace. Han Han, Katu.
The Arawak Mountain Singers honoring the Ancient Ones, the title cut from their really wonderful, wonderful CD. I thought I'd share this story. This just made my blood boil. Yeah, because in 1972, Gene Whitehorse went to an Indian Health Service hospital in Gallup, New Mexico, to treat a ruptured appendix. The 22-year-old mother left her treatment as the victim of a human rights abuse that prevented her from ever having more children. Quote, I became a victim of forced sterilization in the country my father risked for his life as a Navajo code talker. Whitehorse Dene told New Mexico lawmakers during a ceremony for a memorial passed last week that will make New Mexico the first state in the United States to formally investigate the forced and coerced sterilization of Native American women. During the visit to Gallup, the IHS hospital that led to her sterilization, Whitehorse said she was rushed into emergency surgery and was presented with a flurry of forms. A nurse helped her move her hand across the documents to sign consent forms for medical procedures, including one that would lead to her sterilization. A few years later, when Whitehorse struggled to conceive a second child, she learned she had undergone tubal ligation that day in Gallup. She would never be able to carry children again. Whitehorse is just one of thousands of Native American women who underwent procedures without informed consent that rendered them unable to carry children. Forced sterilizations were done by the IHS, the federal agency tasked with providing health care to millions of Native people across the United States. The procedures were first done in 1907 and were reported as recently as 2018, according to the memorial text. The New Mexico Memorial was sponsored by five lawmakers, including two Native American women, Senators Shannon Pinto Dene and Angel Charlie of Laguna Dene. It requested that the New Mexico Indian Affairs Department and Commission on the Status of Women conduct an investigation into the scope and ongoing effects of the abusive practice. By the 1970s, between 25% and 50% of Native women of childbearing age in the United States were sterilized, mainly by the IHS. A large volume of the procedures were performed at IHS facilities in four service areas, including Albuquerque and Gallup, which serve health care to thousands of Native people in the Four Corners. The abuse was first made public with a 1976 report by the U.S. Government Accountability Office, but the story remains incomplete. The report only accounted for IHS medical records from 1972 to 75 and included just four of the 12 IHS service areas. New Mexico Representative Patricia Robal Calbiro, a Piero Manso Tiwa native, a trainer and sexual violence advocate with the Office of Family Representation and Advocacy, told lawmakers at a Senate hearing on February 3rd that she was almost a victim of the practice. Years ago, she was preparing to undergo a standard medical procedure after a miscarriage and was given her consent forms to sign. Already under sedation, she nearly signed a form consenting to a hysterectomy when her husband noticed and stopped her. Had he not, she would have not been able to carry children and would have not given birth to her son, now 38. Royal Caballero didn't speak openly about the incident until last summer when she heard testimony from other Native women who were victims of the forced sterilization practice. Quote, they gave me courage, she said. Caballero noted that forced and coerced sterilization of Native women still occurs. Quote, because of language barriers, poverty barriers, because of women of color are vulnerable in these ways, because of cultural protections, we are being taken advantage of, Caballero said. And quote, and there is a concerted effort, in my opinion, to limit our ability to bear children. Nicole Gonzalez Dene, a certified nurse midwife and founder of the Changing Women Initiative, an Albuquerque-based birth center and reproductive rights group serving Native families, told Native News Online she hopes the memorial leads to more support and funding for Native American birth workers. Quote, part of the healing work that needs to happen is that they acknowledge the wrongdoing that happened, an official apology, and some sort of pathway forward on some reconciliation, whether that's funding or opportunities for organizations who are doing that healing work and integrating culturally birth-supported practices, she said. Gonzalez added that the New Mexico investigation could lead to a national probe. Quote, it happened at other IHS facilities around the country, she said. Quote, is there a potential for Congress to put a hearing through the Senate Committee of Indian Affairs? Yes. Could there be a national study and an inquiry that really studies where this happened and what the implications for the reconciliation repair? Absolutely.
Sabe, sabe, a Pascal, hey, 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 hey,
And that is the Rio Grande Singers. Yes, they are singing to us about a Rio Grande lady. And the Rio Grande River goes through so many of the pueblos. Well, it's been 1 year since Emily Pike's legacy came into existence. And if you don't remember, you're gonna hear about it. I've been past there. I went past the site where her body was found. I've driven by there. It's just an incredible story because turquoise light wraps around the painted portrait of a dead girl. It's part of a makeshift memorial that sits off a highway road beneath Mount Triplett in Peridot. After a year, it has begun to molder. The teddy bear is hanging from a chain-link fence, their fur stiff from the sun and dust. The flowers that were once bright have become faded and brittle at the edges. Emily Pike's mural faces the desert and has started to fade. The elements thin the fabric, drain the blood, drain the color, and fray the edges. Here, a year since the girl's remains were found on Valentine's Day of 2025 off U.S. 60 near Globe. And when I see that name Globe, it's where, you know, somebody hit me. It was just an incredible experience, you know, driving right there on that road in Globe. You know, it's, you know, there's a stop on the other side, you know, so we could make left turns. And as I make my left turn, somebody ran the red light and smashed into the back of my van and then tore through Globe and refused to stop. So, that's the neighborhood. All right. To continue. Near a Globe, time has shown itself has begun to fade, and what hasn't? Emily Pike's name hasn't faded. She is a law. She is a movement. She is a reminder. Her name is spoken in classrooms, at vigils, in group homes, and at the Arizona Capitol. Pike was just 14 years old when she went missing from a group home in Mesa. Valentine's Day marked 1 year since her remains were found in trash bags. They have no arrests in the case. Her uncle, Alfred Pike Jr., remembers her as a teenager who wanted to go to college, who loved art, who cared for her siblings and her parents. Quote, she endured a lot in her young life, yet she looked forwards. She looked towards the future, he said. He hopes people remember her as her family does. Quote, smart, intelligent, he said. And even though she's gone, she made a positive impact on this world. He said that impact is tangible. Since her disappearance, lawmakers passed Emily's law, establishing the turquoise alert system to expand public notification when Indigenous people and other vulnerable individuals go missing. Before her case, there were no statewide alerts exclusively for missing Indigenous people in Arizona. Quote, the first major one is the turquoise alert, Pike Jr. said. Quote, not perfect, but it's a step in the right direction, saving lives, law enforcement paying more attention, bringing awareness. For Mary Kim Tilla, executive director of the United National Indian Tribal Youth, legislation alone does not define Emily's legacy. Tilla said she sees her death as a catalyst. Quote, we didn't have this before the Emily Pike case, and now we have it, she said. Quote, so that's a plus. She says the law may be in place, but real change will depend on continued oversight, accountability, and a commitment from communities and lawmakers to ensure no other child falls through the cracks. What happened to Emily Pike is never far from our minds, Tilla said. Quote, it reminds us that we must promote a message of not only safety, but also of justice. Emily's story has also intensified conversations around missing and murdered Indigenous people, a crisis that families have raised concerns about for decades, but that often struggles for public attention. Emily's name traveled across tribal communities and beyond state lines. Quote, it's just not about Emily, Pike Jr. said. There are other people on other reservations who are still missing, and Pike's story has forced broader recognition that Indigenous families are still waiting for answers, he said. Quote, making sure that her murderers are caught because we need to let all Indian country know that their lives matter, he said. They're not forgotten. Her legacy lives in conversations about what happened before girls go missing. Pike lived in a group home when she went missing. Her case prompted scrutiny of group home oversight, placement practices, and cultural disconnection in Native youths in care. Pike's family filed a lawsuit against Sacred Journey, Inc., operator of the group home in Mesa. The family alleges that Sacred Journey, Inc. failed to provide adequate care and was negligent in its hiring. Sacred Journey, Inc. responded in a legal filing saying that the parents were neglectful and that Pike left the group home, quote, of her own free will. Alicia Manuel, founder of Three Precious Miracles, works weekly inside group homes across Arizona, leading cultural workshops for residents and staff. She describes culture as not just ceremonial. It gives young people a sense of identity, routine, and belonging that can help ground them in otherwise uncertain living conditions. Quote, "These kids are craving their culture, and it's not being provided," Manuel said. In talking circles, she has watched teenagers bead jewelry and begin to cry because it reminded them of their grandmother. She has heard youth say, "The smell of sage feels like home." Quote, "If you imagine stripping your kids away from not only everything they've ever known, but also their culture, their people, their food, that is hard," she said. Pike's case, Manuel said, pushed the system to acknowledge that safety includes making sure Native children are placed in homes where their culture, language, and identity are supported. She advocates for more Native foster parents, stronger kinship placements, and more intensive cultural competency training for those working inside group homes. Quote, "When a child goes into foster care, we always say it takes a village," she said, "but we have to actually build that village." Tilda agrees and said that her work with Native youth focuses on leadership and wellness, but added that safety education and accountability must remain central. Quote, "Anyone who works with a young person must be trained," she said. Quote, "They have to know how to build rapport. They have to know how to prevent violent things from happening to young people." Pike's name, Tilda said, should continue to challenge institutions long after headlines fade. She worries there is a danger in turning a child into a symbol so large that the person disappears. Her uncle wants people to remember who she was, a young girl who deserved stability, education, and the chance to grow up. Quote, "If Emily were still here today," he said, "she would have deserved a, quote, a stable home, environment, education, just giving her the opportunity to be a kid, enjoy life, no worries." Her uncle hasn't returned to the stretch of roadside where her body was found in months. The desert is already erasing what's left. The candles have burned out. The toys sit untouched. Sun and dust keep wearing down the memorial, but one thing has not changed. Pike is dead. Her case remains unsolved, and her uncle and the rest of her family still wait for justice.
I went to a gathering with my friends, all the missing and murdered indigenous. And as I listened to what the speaker had to say, my tears fell when she had us say their names. She said, "Say her name, say her name. We acknowledge you to help you find your way." We said your name, said your name, we said your name, and we'll keep looking until we see you again. Thank you. You know, I saw your mama the other day. I just listened to what she needed to say. I could tell by her voice she was hurting bad. When she told me how you went missing, it was so sad. She said, say her name, say her name. We acknowledge you to help you find your way. We said your name, said your name, we said your name. And we'll keep looking until we see you again. We'll keep looking until we see you again. We'll keep looking until we see you again. We'll keep looking until we see you again.
Emily Pike, say the name. There are so many missing Indigenous women and men. And it doesn't stop, you know. There's so many reasons, especially where the men camps are, where they're digging for that oil or whatever they're mining. They're taken off the streets in Alaska. But we have to keep bringing more and more attention. And I found it ironic last night when that orange head bobblehead was trying to speak. And he started going on and on and about how great America is and how we conquered it and how we went across the country and how dry in the deserts and, you know, and went on and on how brave people were. But he never once mentioned that, oh, yes, there were Indigenous people there too. In fact, he even said, we got rid of DEI. Yes, we're not woke anymore, you know. And then he goes, and they aren't clapping, they aren't standing. He points over to the Democrats that are all sitting there when, you know, he start talking about immigration. And to Representative Green, wow. Because all the, he was, 45 had to walk by him, 47 had to walk by him in that tundra. And all the TV cameras that were there, so he held up a sign that said, black people are not apes. Of course, he got thrown out. And then, you know, the TV cameras immediately turned away. It did not get unnoticed. What I want to do is share a quote from John Trudell. He said, sometimes they have to kill us. They have to kill us because they cannot break our spirit. We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There is a way to live with the earth and a way not to live with the earth. We choose the way of earth. And I know so many of us around here choose that way. And I used to always say, you know, even when you're in San Francisco and you're walking up those hills and then all that cement, underneath all that cement is the earth. It's the roots of earth. And when you realize that, you find the strength to walk up that hill on that cement. Remember who you are. Remember our responsibility to Mother Earth. I'm going to close this is from the Pueblo San Ildefonso Pueblo. It's a flying eagle.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.